might have heard that the Metallica boys were gonna play some heavy shit tonight.
Welcome to another Metal Tales. If you don't know what Metal Tales is, it is a series we do on the show where we talk to patrons about a notable show they went to in the past or a future show. If you've signed up for that, it's real simple and easy, and it's a way for you to participate in Metal Up Your Podcast. I love hearing from the patrons because I like hearing their stories, and at the very least, it gives me an opportunity to tell them thank you for the support. We're here all the way from Oakland, California. Dan Whitney, newer patron, right?
Yeah. I started listening to the show a little over a year ago. And then finally joined the Patreon train.
How did you hear about the podcast?
I think one day I randomly just searched Metallica podcast.
There we go.
Yeah. And I think there wasn't too many other podcasts then. So I just clicked on you guys. I remember the first episode I went to was the James Hetfield episode and loved it.
Nice.
Fell in love. Yeah. So here we are.
Well, now thanks to those knuckleheads in the actual band Metallica, anytime someone just innocuously searches for Metallica podcast, they're going to find the now official Metallica podcast.
Yeah, definitely.
I haven't heard it yet. Have you heard that? Have you heard the official Metallica podcast?
I haven't, no. I've heard, some mixed things on it. I'll definitely listen to it pretty soon, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm interested in it also. Haven't made time for it just yet. I want to talk about this theater show. We're going to be talking about the Fox Theater in Oakland in December of 2016. Because it's one of these rare opportunities, especially after, 1984, maybe, where you get to see the boys in a theater setting. But before we get to that, where does it start for you? What's your online point with the band?
Came online maybe 12, 13, 14, somewhere in there. Was in the car with my dad and my brother coming home from a round of golf. And Enter Sandman came on, and I could not believe it. I couldn't believe just the wall of sound and how incredibly just catchy that song is. Like every once in a while I listen to that, and it's just like flooring, just how good of a song it is. And that mixed with the heavy production and the sound, it's amazing.
I love the idea of it being a post golf sesh.
yeah, kind of random.
I was arguing with my dad about not wanting to do my homework, and then Sad But True came on.
Yeah.
It's like you guys were having a nice father-son bonding sesh on the links, and punctuated by a nice Enter Sandman surprise. That's nice.
Yeah, no, I remember that very clearly, yeah.
Was your dad a fan, maybe? Has your dad maybe heard some of the earlier records, or were you both sort of knocked out by it?
He's into it. You know, he's not a huge fan of Metallica specifically. He's a fan of music, and we had all of our bands that we listened to together, but Metallica was kind of one that I branched out on my own and was discovering.
My dad was a huge Kiss guy. He got me into Kiss, so he was a little spoiled by the theatrics of it. And I remember when I was getting into Metallica, kind of that same age as you, 12, 13, 14, whatever it was, maybe a little younger, I would show him Metallica or Pearl Jam or Nirvana, whatever the early 90s bands I liked. And he just couldn't believe how boring it was to him. You know, he was used to like the dudes dressed up in, 7-inch platform boots. And he would look at a video of Metallica or Pearl Jam and be like, they're just wearing jeans and t-shirts. Why do you like this?
Yeah.
You know, I remember like having that argument with him.
Yeah.
What were you listening to at the time? Like what would have, before you heard Enter Sandman on the radio or whatever, what would have been in your Walkman or your Discman, or what was the band you were talking to your buds about with at school?
We always kind of came from the more punk rockish stuff, but maybe more pop punk. Green Day was a big band for me. American Idiot, I was obsessed with. That was kind of the album that got it all started. And then I kind of moved into like Rise Against, and that band I think kind of opened up maybe a little bit more of the heavier side. I love the singing and the aggression. And that's kind of what led me into Metallica.
Nice. So when you heard Enter Sandman, what year would that have been? Because I'm trying to gauge if, like, you were getting into American Idiot when you were a kid. How old are you?
I'm 26.
Okay.
So this must have been, I don't know, 2006, 2007.
Interesting. So you hadn't heard Saint Anger or S&M or Fuel?
Nope.
Wow, you somehow just heard it. Isn't it interesting that in 2006, you heard basically the debut single off the Black album from 91, and it still hooked you? It was still doing its job that many years later.
Yeah, I don't think it's lost any power that song had.
Wow, that is so cool. Yeah, so for me, I'm about 10 years older than you. For me, the Green Day album was Dookie. You know, when I was in seventh grade, that was just easily the coolest album ever in the world. It like had the right amount of fuck authority or something, a right amount of that sort of adolescent boredom. It was super hooky. And I got to tell you, man, I was a Green Day fan when Dookie came out, but I could never have imagined them maturing to what they became on American Idiot, where it was like they maintained that power, but they'd grown up a little bit. It was real cleaned up. American Idiot might be their best album.
Yeah, it's amazing. I'll go back and listen to it every once in a while, and the songs are just so good.
Did you stick with them? Are you still a Green Day fan?
Yeah, I've kind of, you know, lost touch a little bit. I know they're putting out some newer stuff here and there, but yeah, I'll go back and dive back in here and there. That's kind of the good thing about being around my age and discovering bands when we did, is you kind of can just dive into everything. You
know, totally.
The streaming. I guess it was a little bit before the streaming, but, you know, iTunes and just downloading everything at your fingertips was, you know, made it super easy.
Was it cool to like Metallica in 2006 when in your friend group listening to Green Day? Was everything kind of, you know, open game, or what was it like for you to come back to your friend group and be like, dudes, have you guys heard this Metallica band?
Yeah, I didn't have a whole lot of close friends into Metallica. That came once I got into high school. My buddy Justin, him and I, you know, I finally met somebody that loved Metallica as much as I did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was amazing.
Like, yeah.
It was, you know, it was awesome. And then we got Guitar Hero Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
And we played that a lot. It was mainly just him and I discovering the band and driving in the car together and jamming out. We both played instruments, so mm-hmm. we would jam. I was on the drums and he played guitar, so.
Playing Metallica songs?
Yeah.
Dude, how many of us learn how to play just by trying to figure out all that crap? I mean, I remember the same exact deal. Like, I remember we would like be at the school, you know, lunch table being like, all right, this weekend, everyone show up and know each of us had a different role. I was the James rhythm part. We had a lead guy. We had our drummer. And it'd be like, all right, we're going to do one this weekend. That's the goal. So everyone, how's it coming along? We would like check in. How's it coming on one? You got that double kick, you know?
Yeah.
And this is I don't know. Well, maybe you had the benefit at that time to like look up YouTube tutorials, but we would just have to listen to the record and figure it out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Definitely the guitar tabs and
YouTube. Tabs.
You can learn anything on YouTube, but yeah, it was probably a little bit easier for us. The song we always jammed to was For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know, cause it's a little bit.
Yeah, we did too. Cause it's one of the easier ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so my stepdad played guitar, and we had his amp. It was kind of an old Fender chorus amp.
Yeah.
And we couldn't figure out how to switch on the distortion. So like this was, you know, we were just learning and dude, it sounds kind of weird. I feel like something's missing in your guitar tone. Like, and then I finally discovered the button and flipped it and like this distortion kicks in. It's like, oh, there it is. You know, that's the sound. And
dude, I love that. I mean, you're triggering so many memories I have of similar shit. Like, how do you make it like not knowing what distortion really was?
Yeah.
I remember not knowing what like stomp boxes were. And then you find those little, you crack the code in those little ways. You turn that key, you know, and then you're like, oh, it kind of sounds like My Heroes. You kind of start to get there a little bit. Those are the days of magic, dude. Those are the days of pure fucking magic as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. There's nothing more inspiring than that. Yeah.
What's that buddy up to? Do you keep up with that same buddy?
Yeah, from time to time, you know, social media, this and that.
I've kept up a little bit with some of those dudes I did that with. I had one of the guys on the show, my friend Aaron. He's actually my oldest friend from second grade. He was one of my little Metallica nerds that, you know, we were just total little acolytes of the band. And it's fun to talk to him a little bit about that time. That's maybe worth sending an email and revisiting.
Yeah,
so that would have meant for you, I'm guessing, that Death Magnetic was the first album that came out that was like the new Metallica album when you became a fan.
That's right, yeah.
So when you got into Inner Sandman, did you go back and just did download the whole back catalog and get into...
Yeah, I spent the next several years just...
Catching up.
Spreading my Metallica wings, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I discovered everything, and it was such an exciting time.
It's a lot to unpack. I mean, even for me, getting into the band in the early 90s, it was a lot to unpack, to, like, discover Kill 'Em All, to discover Cliff Burton. You know, there was almost this whole cycle of Metallica before the Black Album that I had to sort of just get acquainted with, you know, which was really fun. And then you basically had two of those. You had the 90s and the 80s to sort of untangle. You must have just camped out in Master of Puppets for months, and then camped out in Justice for months, and et cetera, you know?
Yeah, I remember just going back even to Kill 'Em All and, like, loving it. Like, I just, the fact that you could kind of hear, you know, the freshness of the band and the sound and the production was just, like, I loved it. I found it so, so intriguing. And I think those years when you're discovering, and it just happened at the perfect time, you know, going into high school and throughout high school, kind of makes you, you know, carry it with you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's like, I think even if you had an okay experience in high school or middle school, there's just stuff you're going through emotionally and psychologically that the right music that gets you through it, it'll just be with you the rest of your life. Nothing can ever fuck with it, you know? It's why dummies like me still like Kiss, and it's why my friends like Megadeth, and it's why we in our adult lives like these ridiculous bands. It's because of what they did for us when we were kids, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's why when I, you know, pontificate about Dave Matthews Band, and I can see the far away dead look in the eyes of whoever I'm talking to, I can see their 1,000-yard stare as I continue talking about Under the Table and Dreaming. And it's just because of the market made. So when you got to St. Anger, when you started to dip your toe into that murky water, how did you deal with that material? Did you see the film? Did you like the album? You kind of came at it from a unique perspective on the other side of it.
I didn't have any strong feelings against it. I was kind of, you know, in the middle. I knew I liked the song St. Anger. There's some heavy parts and some kind of monster that you can kind of latch on to the song. But yeah, I actually didn't see the film until later on. But yeah, I mean, I didn't have anything crazily against it. Yeah, I still dip into it. I think it's okay. You kind of have to take it with a grain of salt, because it is, you get tired listening to it if you listen to the whole thing, or, you know, whatever.
It actually might be a good album for if you can't sleep, because it'll wear you out, maybe.
Yeah, for sure.
I usually go for the Radioheads, the Lana Del Reys, the Pink Floyds. But maybe I've been missing my sleep anxiety for a long time. Maybe it's just cranking up St. Anger at an unreasonable decibel. And then maybe by the middle of it, I'm put out, because I'm just completely worn out.
Yeah, I don't know how you fall asleep to music, man. I would just, my mind would just be running.
You know what's funny? My wife is the same way. She can't understand it, but what's weird about it is the exact opposite for me. If I don't have it, my mind races too much. And it's almost like having a song to listen to and kind of fall into it gives my mind a break.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't be able to go to sleep to like a podcast or like I actually have a friend, I won't say who it is, but I do have a friend who he goes to sleep every night listening to, not watching, listening to The Office, the show, the American version of The Office.
Oh yeah.
He just puts it on his phone, but puts his phone face down, can't see it, and he goes to sleep to the dialogue of The Office.
Yeah.
Like, that would distract me, but I guess it's whatever. I mean, dude, I was going to sleep when I was like 12 to Cowboys from Hell. So I guess if your starting place is like something that heavy and aggressive, like I would go to sleep to KSAD by Sepultura and stuff. So again, it's all those little neuron pathways you make when you're a kid, for better or worse.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, do you forever associate Inner Sandman now with the game of golf? Does it make you think of golf at least a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. I'll remember back to that day and that being in the car. But that song has just, you know, been with me for however many years now, and like, you know, just feeling the way that you change with the band, and you know, it just goes so far, you know.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about. Yes, because it's been 15 years for you.
Yeah.
And especially from being a teenager to being 26, and then you're going to experience another big change from 26 to 36. And is funny how these songs just stay with you through all of those different levels.
Yeah, and I think they always, you know, they always change as you change. Like, I discover new things within the band, you know, as I get older. I think that's kind of what keeps everybody coming back, you know.
Totally. Great point. So what was the first time you saw him?
I saw him actually on the World Magnetic, I think it was.
Okay.
It was 2008 in San Jose in the Shark Tank. They played a ton of Death Magnetic stuff, I remember. And that was still when I was kind of branching out and discovering. So being able to hear, I remember hearing Cyanide, hearing like that bass part, and not knowing that song just yet.
Yeah, that kind of funky bass part.
Yeah, so it was fun.
Would have been December 12th, 2009?
Yeah, that's it.
Let's take a look at this set list, see what's cracking here. So this is your first Metallica gig. Oh, yeah. That was just your life. End of the Line. Ride the Lightning, song 3. That's fun. Harvester of Sorrow, Fade to Black, Broken, Beaten, Scarred, Cyanide, number 7, Sabbath True, 1, My Apocalypse, Day That Never Comes, Puppets, Fight Fire, Nothing Else Matters, Sandman, For the Encore, Helpless, Motor Breath, and Seek. And it looks like Machine Head and Volbeat open. Did you catch the openers?
Yeah, we caught Volbeat.
What do you think about that?
They're cool. I think he's got a cool voice. Some cool songs. I kind of dipped in for a little bit. Because I remember knowing that they were opening for them. So I was like, I'm going to check this band out. Discovered them and I'm a fan.
Yeah, that dude has a really unique voice for sure. I remember when single they had or whatever people in Birmingham, Alabama liked. I guess this is when I was also in high school. I remember we kind of made fun of it. Because it was so bizarre sounding, kind of the way we made fun of Adam Duritz, you know, Mr. Jones, but also like Mr. Jones, I liked whatever that Volbeat song was, you know, it's like sometimes like a funny voice or something like the System of a Down guy, it kind of hooks you in, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So did you see them again between this 2009 date and 2016?
I saw them in 2015 in Vegas when they were doing the Rock in Rio. And I think it was like, the first time in the States or something like that.
Let's check this set list out at the MGM Festival Grounds. All right. Dude, people should just fucking hire me to Google shit. May 9th. Yeah, so it's Rock in Rio, USA, which that's interesting. And so this is the first time they did it in the States, you said?
Something like that. I don't know. I don't remember. I remember being a little bit confused on that fact, but
call it Rock in Vegas. All right, so this was the other acts were Linkin Park, Deftones, and Sepultura. Okay, fun. The set list, they open with Fuel, Puppets, King Nothing, Disposable Heroes, another treat as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. Sanitarium, Lords of Summer, a treat. The Unforgiven, Cyanide, Sabbath True, Turn the Page 1, Bells, Blackened, Nothing, Sandman, Encore, Whiskey, Creep, and Seek. Great set list.
Yeah, I remember, I think I looked up the facts not too long ago. And I think that was the first time they played Lords of Summer in the States or something like that. Something pretty cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love that song.
How far is Vegas from Oakland?
That'd be a pretty good drive. I remember we flew down.
Okay.
I went with my parents, yeah. And I think the drive would probably be like, I don't know, 8 to 10 hours, something like that.
Yeah, you were right. It's the first time Lords of Summer was performed in the U.S., because I guess they had been playing it on the summer European tour. First time in 21 years that Disposable Heroes was performed in Vegas. The first time in 4 years that King Nothing was played. Man, let me ask you this, Dan. Why don't they play King Nothing more than they do? That song kicks ass. It was a hit. People like it. Why do they go such long stretches without playing that song? I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a song to me that could be on the Black Album. Like, it's so heavy. It's not super fast tempo.
Yeah.
Got all the riffs. You know, I don't think it's too physically demanding. I think, they should squeeze it in more.
In fact, if you go, if you look at Metallica.com, which I love Metallica.com for this stuff. Like, I never look at setlist.com. It's just pales. But the two videos they have from the show are Disposable Heroes and King Nothing. So I will be watching that after this.
Yeah.
The venue looked really cool. I mean, unique looking setup for the stage. Did you see Sepultura or Linkin Park or the Deftones?
Linkin Park, Rise Against. I think it went Rise Against, Linkin Park, and then Metallica.
Oh, okay, cool.
It was kind of a festival, so there was multiple stages going on.
Yep.
I remember got there, you know, whatever it was, like noon or one or two or something crazy, and I knew Metallica was on the main stage, so I just posted up, and I think Metallica came on at like midnight.
Oh, that's so fun.
But yeah, it was a long day.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got pretty close to being on the rail. So
yeah, I mean, I remember being that age where I'm like, dude, they go on at midnight. That's awesome. Now I'm like, oh, they go on at midnight. I don't know if I'm going to make it, dude.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's really going to factor into whether or not I can make it. All right. So any other times between Vegas 2015 and December of 2016?
Nope, that was it.
So let's talk about this Fox Theater gig. It looks like the day before they played the Fonda Theater in LA, they were kind of coming off like the House of Vans type club stuff. They would go on to do Webster Hall, which is one of my favorite live recordings of theirs. Man, they did the Apollo, of course. I love these theater gigs. So was it like was it kind of like a secret announced show, or was this just a normal show that went on sale like anywhere else? Because I mean, what's the cap in this place? Like 5,000 people?
Yeah, it wasn't very many. I think it was like a fifth member thing.
Okay. That makes sense.
So I mean, you know, you could get tickets if you really wanted to, but I think it was pretty hard.
So were you plugged into like the fifth member Metallica.com? Are you like active on the forums and stuff?
I used to be, not on the forums, but I kept up with the fifth member stuff. Just, you know, whenever shows would come around, but yeah, I'm not super active with that stuff.
But I guess you would get an email that was like, hey, just FYI, this show's going to go on sale. And you're like, shit, we should go to that.
Yeah.
Because to me, that I would love to see them in a place like this. I love these beautiful theaters. It's just a trip. It doesn't have that same, you know, those arenas and the stadiums just have that kind of generic. It's hard to make them feel cozy and comfy and vibey. And I'm so used to seeing the boys like in the round where they're always kind of on one corner of a rectangle. I like that sort of classic, just the four of them on a tight stage. Not a lot of fanfare in production, really just some lights in the show. Did you go into it sort of in tune with that it was going to be kind of more of an intimate vibe?
Yeah, I remember being really excited, you know, seeing Metallica the other couple times before this is in a big festival, the big arena, and like they're super far away. But
yeah,
I remember just being really excited to be able to see them up close. And yeah,
like maybe Lars could spit some of that seltzer water in your mouth at some point.
I think I got a guitar player, so I didn't get any of Lars's spit. But
were you pretty close to the stage?
Yeah, we were pretty close, and I remember, you know, being kind of on the floor, the standing admission. The crowd is, you know, moving around. Everybody's kind of a mosh pit, and you know, you guys talk about how it's like an ocean moving.
Yeah,
you just get tossed around.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're up front, sometimes you get moved over to the side. And yeah,
it's kind of an experience you really have to sort of be down for. It's almost like falling down the stairs. It's like you need to just sort of go with it. Don't fight it. You're going to do better if you just are a little loose in there.
Yeah. But like the good thing is, I think most people around you that are in that situation are there for all the same reasons. You know, everybody's there to just enjoy the music and enjoy the band. So I've always thought those situations are harmless, you know.
Totally. And so you're kind of swaying with the crowd. Have you watched, so the videos that are on Metallica.com for that, which I did watch, I watched the Creeping Death. They have a dual video of Creeping Death and Blackened, and then they have a video of Hardwired. Can you see yourself in any of those videos? Have you looked?
I think there's one point, I can't remember where it is. Everybody kind of looks the same, but yeah,
everyone's just sweaty and blurred together. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, there's a good video that somebody put together. I think he just brought in like a bunch of different fan footage and kind of put it into one video to make it seem like a, you know, one video for the whole concert. So that's a good one to check out too.
I went to, you know, a handful of shows on the arena tour in the States, and I made it into a couple of those videos, and I don't look cool in any of them, dude. I mean, I look the way you look at a Metallica show. I'm like in awe, you know, like it's your heroes right there. It is always kind of funny to see yourself, though. So Hardwired had just come out. Did you get the record right when it came out? Did you dig it? Were you excited about the new tunes?
Yeah, I loved it. Big fan.
It's funny when you're a fan of a band at this point in their career. You know, I heard Chris Rock talk about this on the, there was a really great HBO special called Talking Funny, and it's Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, Louis C.K., and Ricky Gervais. Did you ever see that? It's just them talking about stand-up comedy for about an hour. Anyway, they're talking about the idea that George Carlin did a lot of, where every year he would do a brand new hour of comedy every year. Whereas someone like Seinfeld comes from a more old school thing of, you take the best material of each year and you're always building on it, and you may have a joke in your set that's like 20 years old.
Yeah.
And they use this analogy where they go, you know, no one wants to go to a Prince concert and see the new Prince album. Everyone wants to go, and this is obviously before Prince passed away. They're like, everyone wants to go see Prince so he'll play his hits, right? And Chris Rock makes this great point where he's like, man, there was a 20-year period where you wanted to hear Prince's new album, like, you know. And it's interesting that Metallica, they could have just easily made a disposable cookie cutter album with maybe one or two songs worth of shit, and then just played their massive catalog, you know. But I just love that they made an album that guys like me and you wanted to hear the new stuff live. That's a remarkable achievement, in my opinion.
Yeah, I remember being very interested in listening and reading the lyrics. You know, it's just so fun to just see where James is at, you know, with his writing. And, you know, he wrote songs like Moth into Flame. And, you know, he always gives a little speech before they play it, like, oh, this song about your phone or something like that.
So it's
just so interesting to hear where he's at with that stuff.
It's funny that you put it that way. That just sparked a memory in me of, like, I remember reading the lyrics, hearing like Atlas Rise for the first time. And I remember thinking about it specifically in the way that you just said it, of like, oh, this is kind of what James is thinking about now. And that itself just being interesting to me because of how much I respect him.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a cool way to think about it.
And I just was really excited to read the lyrics, and it's just so exciting to, you know, have something new.
Did you have a favorite, like a standout favorite then? And what is your favorite tune from the album now after 4 years?
Spit Out the Bone was the one I couldn't get enough of. Now, Halo on Fire. I think James's voice really shines both in the chorus, verse. I think it's an awesome song, and it's just kind of that classic kind of ballad start that goes into a thrash masterpiece. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's like really one of the only moments like that on the album, except for maybe like the intro to Murder One. That kind of real big, clean, pretty thing.
Yeah.
And I guess, Halo and Fire kind of like is like the ballad template of Hardwired, right?
Yeah, definitely.
So let's talk about the set list. So I am so jealous of this opener, Bread Fan. I mean, such an amazing song. It's one of my favorite covers of theirs. It just burns the fucking house down. And I think it's such a great opener. Did they come out and do the whole, like, kind of leave the lights on for Bread Fan? Sometimes they do that when they open with covers.
I remember they just went straight into it. They were just all of a sudden kind of appeared, and the lights were off, and you couldn't see anything. And then the riff, James ripped into the riff, and then the lights came on, and it was like, oh my God, it's happening.
So no opener or anything, right? It was just like evening with Metallica?
Yeah, there was no ecstasy or anything. It was just... straight into it.
Let me ask you this. So you're in the crowd at the Fox Theater. Are you the kind of dude who is making friends with the people around you out of excitement, or are you kind of more of a lone wolf type vibe?
I think I'm a little both, you know. I mean, it's so easy to make friends. Everybody's there to have a good time, and everybody has, you know, Metallica in common. So so easy to spike up a conversation. And I remember, you know, being with Hardwired being so fresh, everybody was talking about it.
Yeah.
So it was just so easy to strike up conversation.
So what do you think about Hardwired? I like it.
Yeah.
What do you think about it? I like it too, man. Yeah. I'm the same way, dude. I'm by nature extremely introverted, but I do find something about being in the show surrounded by other people who love this thing as much as I do. It brings out something more gregarious in me for sure.
Yeah.
I'm a little more interested in talking to other people and figuring out what their deal is, especially with new album stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
And then also there's that fun speculation of like, what do you think they're going to open with? What do you think, you know, you think we're going to get Fade to Black? I mean, you know, it's fun to, were you keeping up with some of the set list? Did you look at the set list from the night before and maybe try to glean from that what they might throw at you?
No, I've never really been into the set list thing. I get my updates just from watching their concerts on YouTube.
Ah, gotcha.
So I don't really do that kind of research. I kind of just go into it with an open mind, I guess.
That's the way to do it, man. That's the way to do it, because you're setting yourself up to be surprised and excited. I watch I mean, I follow several Dave Matthews Band Twitter accounts that do real-time set list updates, and I just religiously read them. And we're playing a show with Dave Matthews in September, and I read every set. I do like an aggregate of every set list. So in some ways, I'm sort of spoiling it for myself what's possible for that show.
Yeah.
It's almost like cracking your knuckles. I told my daughter, she was like, why do you crack your knuckles? And I'm like, well, I can't stop doing it. Don't start doing it, because then you won't be able to stop. Maybe if you never get into the set list chasing thing, it never even occurs to you, and then you can just live a happy life.
Yeah.
Maybe it's that simple. So Bread Fan into Creep. I love the Creep into Blackened. Well, how about that for a 1-2 punch?
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. It was crazy.
Actually, the whole run, they do Bread Fan, Creep, Blackened, Sabbath True, Fade to Black. Like, those dudes were not letting up. Was there like a different kind of I'm curious about this. Was a different kind of vibe with James in a more intimate theater setting? Was he a little more talky with the crowd, or was he sort of business as usual frontman stuff?
He was pretty business as usual. I mean, he was in the zone, man. You could tell he lots of energy, and yeah, he was putting it all out there. Between I think Creep and Blackened, they just went straight into it. They didn't like trash can or anything. They've no pause, like straight into Blackened. Like,
man,
it was cool.
Yeah. Just like a tight machine.
Yeah.
So after that, you get Atlas from the new album, which I think went over really great live. I think I like it live more than the album, and I like the album version a lot. But that one seemed to work really well live, especially in the arenas. I bet it sounded great in the theater.
And you could tell, like, being that the album was so fresh, like, they were performing those songs. Like,
they were stoked.
Perfectly. Yeah, they were on it.
That's what I like. That's what I like about the House of Vans on the Webster Hall shows, is that exact thing. You can really hear that.
Yeah, and Kirk was on fire, too. I mean, maybe his solos, you know, aren't the best on that album, but I think he really delivers them live. You know, and I'll take that, you know, over the opposite. If he nails a solo on the record, but he can't play it live. Like,
I agree. We've been kind of hard on the solos on the album, and, you know, I don't think we've talked about that in a couple of years, but I don't, you know, my big theory is I don't think they thought many people would care about the album. I just don't think they thought that. I don't know. I don't really know what's going on with that. I think it was a big wake up call, and you can mark my words. This is a prediction I have. I think the next Metallica album, Kirk's going to show up in a big way.
Yeah.
Because I think he was surprised that people cared and that we all paid attention to the point that we were like, man, we feel like the only lazy thing about the album might have been like the composition of the solos. I think he's going to respond to that. Yeah, that's my opinion.
Yeah, I agree.
And I agree with you too, man. I think he stepped it up live, like the Halo and Fire stuff live. And I actually really grew to like the recorded solos for Now That We're Dead. I love the recorded solo for Dream No More. Spit's really good. So, you know, it's grown on me too.
Yeah.
So you've got Harvester of Sorrow, always good. Moth. So were they doing anything with Pyro with Moth in the theater? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. They had kind of like a light show going on, you know, changing backdrop and things like that. I don't remember any Pyro.
What was on the backdrop? Like images?
No, it was just like blank, like kind of iridescent light, you know, kind of would light up the stage a little bit, and then the rest of the theater would be, you know, dark. So it'd have a cool light setup on the band.
Yeah, I dig that. I dig, like, the focus is just more on the music in that environment.
Yeah,
which I think is really fun.
That was the cool thing about the show, and I think it has to do with this being in a smaller venue. It's very much just about the performance, you know. It was just on the nose, like, here we go, jumping straight into it. It was awesome.
One of the I talked to one of their LDs when they played Birmingham. Me and Paul got a brief little tour of the stage and stuff, and he was like, you know, the band, he was being cool about it. He was like, James just, he thinks that no one wants to see these four dudes play songs. It's really important to James to have like a lot of production value, because, you know, people are paying their hard earned money for the tickets and maybe getting, you know, it's a big investment. And he's like, yeah, it's hard for him to believe that people just want to watch them play their songs. And I was just laughing. Yeah. I'm like, we do just want to watch them play their songs. Now, if they want to have, you know, drones and fire and coffins and, you know, an electric chair that, you know, Doris crashes, and great, I'll take all that too. But I do think most of us would be totally fine just watching them play Creeping Death.
Yeah, I think that's definitely what they were going for with the show. Like, they they definitely meant business.
I wonder why they did those. I wonder if they were, because I know that the next gig, I think the next gig after the one you saw was like the Sky Dome in South Korea or something, the next January. So maybe those were just kind of like pre-holiday, I was going to say warm-up shows, but I don't know. I wonder why they did those little bitty shows.
I was going to say warm-up, you know, but it's like they, it didn't seem like a warm-up. Like they did not perform like it was warm-up.
Right. You
know? So maybe they were just, yeah, doing something a little special for the new album, change it up a little bit.
I guess you think of a warm-up show with them being kind of loose, kind of trying to figure out what's working, but it sounds like you're saying the show is like really tight. And so, and maybe that's just them. Maybe that is them. Maybe that's why they're the best, is them doing a warm-up show is them sounding like the well-oiled machine that we've come to love.
Yeah.
So after Moth, you get One, Puppets, Bells, and Sandman. Oh, No, Nothing Else Matters. That's an unusual facet of this show. No, Nothing Else Matters.
I was okay with that. I think the show carried a lot of momentum. Like it was one on to the next, and yeah, they were playing all their bangers, and I think Nothing Else Matters might have slowed down the momentum a little bit. Nothing against the song. I don't mind not seeing it live.
Yeah, I'm with you. If they wanted to skip it, I'd be cool. I'm also cool seeing it every time too. I'm easy on that. Same with Sandman.
I think it is cool seeing James Boyce, you know, strip down and hear him sing that song.
And then, you know, let's face it, it's nice to see him kick the chair.
We all
want to see him kick a chair every once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
So did they do the traditional encore thing? They went away, everyone goes crazy, you know they're going to come back out, lights are down. Did they do that whole thing?
Yeah, it wasn't a very long pause. I remember, I think they didn't even leave the stage, but I remember Rob played a little doodle somewhere in there, like a little solo, but he kind of just jams on riffs, you know, which I like. I don't like when he tries, or when, you know, bass solos are super impressive. You know, I think it's cool when they just can go out there and jam on a couple of riffs in front of a theater, you know?
That's what I would do. I mean, I'm not trying to do any like slapping shit, you know, at a Metallica concert. So then they do Whiskey, which if I had to choose another cover other than Bread Fan, that would be like reasonable that they would play. Like they don't play the Prince, you know, or Blitzkrieg. I might choose Whiskey because I guess in that slot, they could have played Turn the Page, Die My Darling, I don't know, the Misfits tunes, not Die My Darling, Last Caress, Green Hell. I might take that. But Whiskey I love. Yeah. That's one of my favorite covers.
Yeah, it's cool. They switch guitars, and they down-tuned. It sounds heavy.
Yeah.
James plays the solos, and he just rips those things. Like, he sounds so good, and he's able to just nail those transitions in and out of the solos back into the verses.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. I don't think he, you know, I think we try to draw attention to it when we talk about it on the show, but I absolutely love his solo playing on that song. And even on the recording, it's like a little long. Like, there's definitely a point where I'm like, the solo could have ended, but it just keeps going. But I don't know, like, I like his phrasing. He's definitely got a unique approach to soloing that kind of keeps you interested, you know?
Yeah, he's very melodic and plays with legato, and I think it contrasts really nicely from Kirk's playing, because Kirk's kind of, you know, he's the shreddy, he's got pretty heavy hands,
mm-hmm.
and then James just kind of comes in with these super smooth legato, you know, beautiful lines. I think they just go well, really, really nicely.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well said. Beautiful legato lines. He does have like a softer touch.
Yeah.
And, you know, I bet Kirk loves it too, man. I bet Kirk's like, man, go out there and have fun. He gets to just bang away. I remember in the video, he's just like smoking a cigar the whole time. It's like a little break for him almost.
Yeah.
So then you get Hardwired and Seek. Did they do a big drawn out Seek where they get everybody excited and sing in the chorus together? And
yeah.
How about writing that song when you're 22 or 21 or whatever, and it just still being, you know, 30 years later, your closing anthemic song that everybody loves. I'm just forever blown away by that.
Yeah, that would be something cool to hear James talk about, like performing those songs that are as big as they are now, but he wrote them a completely different time in his life.
Yeah, he must just, I was talking to my friend Bob Schneider, who's a really great songwriter, and he's got, in his own little sphere of influence in the world, he's got songs that are just staples at his shows. And we were talking about that recently, where I was like, you know, it must be weird when you're performing it, you're almost reliving the song, but you're not who you were when you wrote it. And I'm sure James would say that. So I wonder, yeah, I wonder psychologically if you're, is he kind of zoned out doing it? Because sometimes, I mean, you know, this as playing an instrument, you can be playing all the right notes, but kind of not be there mentally. Like, I wonder if he does that or if he just has a different place to put it all these years later. That would be an interesting question for him.
Yeah, and I think as much as they play that song, he has to have, you know, a place that he goes with it in order to play it that many times. You
know? Without going insane, yeah.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
sure. All right, well, what about after this gig? Did you see them on any other of the worldwide tours?
I saw them at Outside Lands in San Francisco. I think that was 2017 or 2018. And then I was at S&M 2.
Ah, tell me about S&M 2. What did you go to both nights? One night?
We went to the second night. We scored a box ticket. Spot.
And how is that? Are you hearing the sound pumped into that box or are you hearing the sound in the arena?
We're hearing it from the arena.
Yeah, some of those like VIP boxes, they kind of pump the sound in because there's glass yeah. maybe or whatever.
Yeah, that I remember going into that show, I was a little bit more in tune with what they were playing, you know, just following the previous shows that they played leading up to it. You know, I saw they were playing like Outlaw Torn.
Yeah.
And
Call of Cthulhu.
Halo on Fire. And just kind of getting excited in that way.
Yeah, it was fun seeing some of those gigs before where they played Call of Cthulhu, they played Outlaw Torn, I think they played No Leaf Clover. It was like, oh shit, man, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm a big, big Outlaw Torn fan, so I love seeing that.
Yeah, you know, when we talked to Edwin Outwater, he mentioned that basically the only coin flip on the set list that he was aware of was between that one and Bleeding Me.
Yeah, I would have taken either one.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how about Bleeding Me one night and Outlaw the other? But I get it. They needed both nights for the recordings and I get it.
Yeah. They're both pretty big songs.
They're both epic. Yeah.
That would be, you know, a lot of work to switch it up, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are your thoughts about Metallica moving forward? You know, there's a lot of talk about, obviously most of the talk right now is about the Black Album. But yeah. There's this idea that they have a newer album coming out sooner than later, and they kind of took quarantine time to get creative. And you have any thoughts about what the next album might be?
I think we're in for a good surprise. Like, I honestly think it could go, I think they might get a little experimental, you know, with everything that's happening in the world. And there's just a lot of good stuff that they can make out of what's going on these days.
I could definitely see them as artists, and they've always been that way. I feel like they've always leaned more on that. So the integrity of the artistic side of their deal. I could definitely see them want to do something a little more experimental, but I also could see them being like, man, our last album was so good, so well received. Maybe let's not mess with that so we can go out with a bang. I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if you compare Hardwired to Death Magnetic, one could say Hardwired is a bit experimental, you know, so that could,
sure,
you know, Who knows?
That could have been their psychedelic album.
Yeah, so they might come back with a thrasher. So yeah, who knows?
Dude, I wouldn't mind getting an album of just like 3 to 4 minute kind of punk rock, kill 'em all-ish thrasher bangers.
Yeah,
that would be fun.
I think the song Hardwired like is awesome for that. Like, I think that's obviously what they were going for, and they nailed it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that was one of the last songs they wrote for the album. So you may be onto something there.
Yeah.
Well, dude, I appreciate you taking the time to tell us your story. I enjoyed hanging out with you this hour. Super fun to talk to you. Thank you for supporting us on Patreon. We're having a good time over there. And you know, we couldn't do it without people like you. So I really appreciate you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, man. Thanks for having me. Good to meet you.
Good to meet you too, man.
Hey, everyone. Clinton Ethan here. And we want to tell you about a little thing called Patreon. Patreon is an easy and interactive way to support the people who make the things that you love.
For as little as $5 a month, you can ensure that Metal Up Your Podcast can continue to grow in quality and content. That's equivalent to a cup of coffee or a beer once a month.
Not only is it easy and affordable, but we've made it a priority since day one to give back to our Patreon community. We've given away deluxe box sets, rare vinyl, Black and Whiskey,
concert tickets to S&M2 and Slane Castle,
all 4 of our Cover Our World Black and EPs, 26 quarantine covers, and Lunar Satan demos,
invitations to exclusive Zoom happy hours, the ability to ask our guests like Jay Weinberg of Slipknot, Lizzie Hale, and members of the Metallica crew your very own questions,
and eligibility for our Metal Tales series, where you can be a guest on Metal Up Your Podcast and tell us all about a notable Metallica show you've been to.
Subscribe to Patreon today and immediately get access to years worth of bonus content.
Thank you for supporting the people who make the things that you love. Peace.
Adios.
I can't talk about it anymore. It's giving me a headache.
Here, take two of these.
Ah, Nuprin. Little. Yellow. Different.